midway by a road connecting Newmarket and Luray. Here was where Jackson fixed his eye, and the harder he looked, the more he saw in the way of opportunities. The road net thus enclosing Massanutten resembled an elongated italicized capital H, with Strasbourg, Newmarket, and Harrisonburg forming the western upright, and Front Royal, Luray, and Conrad's Store forming the eastern upright. The crossbar between Newmarket and Luray was the key. Whoever held it could move up or down either shank of the H, not only with his own flank protected, but also with an excellent chance of striking the flank of an enemy in motion on the opposite side. Then, too, the narrow eastern valley afforded an ideal covered approach for gaining the rear of an army coming southward up the pike, as Banks had done. Afterwards, if necessary, the attacker could make a quick escape by retracing his steps and swinging eastward through the passes of the Blue Ridge while the enemy was trying to get at him by marching around either end of the 40-mile-long mountain. Ripe as were the opportunities awaiting him back in the valley, they would never be available to an army that straggled as badly as his had done on the march to Kernstown. Since then, the marching had improved, but not enough. Mindful of Lee's suggestion that the troops must be efficient and light, Jackson issued on May 13th, while his men were clearing their lungs of the smoke they had breathed in pursuit of Milroy, an order requiring strict discipline on the march. The troops were to fall in at attention, step off in cadence, hold it for 200 or 300 yards before shifting to route step, and maintain prescribed intervals thereafter. No one was to leave the column for any reason whatever except by express permission from an officer. 50 minutes of each hour they were to march. The other 10 were for rest, which preferably was to be taken prone. "A man rests all over when he lies down," Jackson said. He had little patience with frailty. A broken-down man and a straggler were two of a kind to him. As one of his officers remarked, he classed all who were weak and weary, who fainted by the wayside, as men wanting in patriotism. If a man's face was as white as cotton, and his pulse so low you could scarcely feel it, he looked upon him merely as an inefficient soldier and rode off impatiently. The men grumbled, seeing in the order further evidence of their general's crack-brained meticulosity, but having no choice, they obeyed. In time, they even saw sense in it, especially after compliance had transformed them into such rapid marchers that they became known as foot cavalry. Having prescribed the exact manner in which it was to be conducted, Stonewall was ready that same day to begin his march back to Stanton and beyond. Whatever its shortcomings as a tactical victory, the Battle of McDowell had earned him certain definite advantages. Despite his losses, he would be returning to the valley with about 2,500 more soldiers than he had had when he left 2 weeks ago. Johnson himself would not be coming. He had suffered a bad leg wound in the fight. But his men would, in spite of the fact that it meant leaving Fremont's advance down the Alleghenies unopposed. As far as Jackson was concerned, there was no longer much danger from that direction. He could turn his back on Fremont and walk off, as if dismissing him absolutely from his mind. In bullfight terms, or for that matter in veterinary jargon, he had fixed him. For Ewell, back at Conrad's Store, the past 2 weeks had been the most unhappy I ever remember. I never suffered as much with dyspepsia in my life. He had cause. Recently, he had learned that one of Banks's two divisions was preparing to march east to join McDowell. According to Johnston's orders, this would require him to follow, but Jackson had left strict instructions for him to stay where he was until the rest of the Valley Command returned. Ewell hardly knew what to do. "I have been keeping one eye on Banks, one on Jackson, all the time jogged up from Richmond until I am sick and worn down." Stonewall, that enthusiastic fanatic, Ewell called him, was keeping his intentions to himself, limiting his communications mostly to announcements of things past. As, for instance, a dispatch informing his lieutenant that with the aid of divine providence he had captured much of Milroy's wagon train. Ewell could find little comfort in this, nor could he fathom the connection. "What has Providence to do with Milroy's wagon train?" he asked, distracted and outdone. On May 17th, the crisis became acute with the arrival of definite information that one of Banks's divisions, under Major General James H. Shields, had already crossed the Blue Ridge on its way to Fredericksburg. Though Johnston's orders left him no choice except to follow, Ewell saw that to do so would be to give up a rare chance to annihilate Banks, who was pulling his remaining division back down the pike toward Strasburg. Deciding to delay his departure at least long enough for a talk with Jackson, next morning Ewell rode west, beyond Harrisonburg, and met the valley commander approaching that place at the head of his marching men. Stonewall's eyes flashed at the news of Banks's depletion, but then were clouded with regret that Johnston's orders denied him the chance to take advantage of it. Infected by his enthusiasm, Ewell offered to stay and lend a hand if Jackson would cover him with a letter of instructions. Quickly this was done, and Ewell returned to Conrad's store, much happier than when he left that morning. Jackson had given him orders to prepare to march, as well as a dazzling glimpse into the secret corners of his mind. Banks now had 9,000 men occupying the three points of a triangle which rested against the northern face of Massanutten Mountain. 1,500 at Winchester, his main base of supplies, 1,000 at Front Royal, where the vital Manassas Gap Railroad crossed the Shenandoah River, and 6,500 at Strasburg, entrenched to block an attack down the valley pike. As protection against guerrilla raids, these dispositions were judicious, but they were something less than that against anything more substantial. Banks was quite aware of this, and as a result had been feeling apprehensive ever since he learned of Ewell's arrival at Conrad's store. In point of fact, however, he had brought this predicament on himself. A self-made man at 46, he had risen rapidly in politics and business. 3 times governor of Massachusetts, speaker of the Federal House of Representatives, and president of the Illinois Central Railroad, he was determined to do as well in his new career, which might bring him the largest rewards of all. On April 28th, he had wired the War Department that he was entirely secure at Harrisonburg. "The enemy is in no condition for offensive movements," he declared. 2 days later, while Jackson was setting out on his roundabout march to Stanton, Banks reported him, "Bound for Richmond. This is the fact. I have no doubt. There is nothing to be done in this valley." There was the rub. He wanted to be where guns were booming and reputations could be gained, not often in an active theater watching the war go by. That night he wired again, suggesting that his corps be sent to join McDowell or McClellan. Satisfied that this would be the most safe and effective disposition possible, he added, "I pray your favorable consideration. Such order will electrify our force." Stanton took him at his word, but not to the extent he had intended. After conferring with Lincoln, the secretary instructed Banks to send, not bring, one, not both, of his divisions beyond the Blue Ridge to McDowell, who would move south to join McClellan's assault on Richmond as soon as the valley troops arrived to reinforce him. Here, then, was the natural explanation for the seemingly miraculous response to McClellan's prayers at the chancel of St. Peter's. As for Banks, his plan for gaining a share of the glory available on the peninsula had resulted in nothing so far but the loss of half his force, and the better half at that, for it was Shields who had whipped Jackson at Kernstown back in March. Meanwhile, Ewell had come onto the scene, replacing the vanished Stonewall, who was presently making havoc west of Stanton. Banks, growing cautious, drew back to Strasburg and dug in, preparing to fight whatever came at him down the pike. The electrification he had sought was closer than he knew, and it would not come from Washington. After sending Ewell back to Conrad's store with instructions to advance 2 of his 3 brigades to Luray, Jackson continued his march through Harrisonburg, preceded by a screen of cavalry, and made camp just south of New Market on May 20th. Later that day, Ewell's 3rd Brigade joined him after a trek around the south end of the mountain. Jackson sat on a rail fence, sucking thoughtfully at a lemon as he watched the troops arrive. Bayonets glinting steely in sunlight, 3,000 neat gray uniforms glided past in strict alignment above the cadenced flash of white gaiters. They were Louisianians, Creoles, and Irishmen, plus a battalion of New Orleans wharf rats under Robert O. Wheat, who had put his case on record at Manassas. When they reached their assigned bivouac areas, the commands to halt were given in French. Gobble talk, the valley soldiers called it, and hooted at the sound. Presently they had more to hoot about. The bands switched to polkas. The men broke ranks, clasped each other about the waist, and began to dance. Stonewall sat and watched in silence, the lemon gleaming yellow in his beard. "Thoughtless fellows for serious work," he said. Another command crisis was threatening to cost him their services even now. Some hours before, a courier from Ewell had crossed the mountain with a dispatch just received from Johnston, vetoing the proposed attack and ordering him to follow Shields across the Blue Ridge while Jackson stayed behind to observe Banks. This meant that the plan to drive him back toward the Potomac would have to be abandoned. Ewell had no choice except to obey, unless the peremptory order was countermanded by higher authority, meaning Davis himself. Jackson moved swiftly, wiring an appeal to Lee in Richmond. "Please answer by telegraph at once," it ended, and instructing Ewell to stay where he was, pending the outcome of the plea for intercession. Now there was the strain of waiting. None of it showed, however, as Stonewall sat on the rail fence pulling thoughtfully at the lemon. When the commander of the Louisianians, Brigadier General Richard Taylor, requested instructions for tomorrow's march, Jackson merely informed him that it would begin at earliest dawn and the newly arrived brigade would head the column. When Taylor asked, not unreasonably, it seemed to him, in which direction they would move, Jackson replied that he would be with him by then to point the way. He was there before daylight glimmered, and if there was extreme pleasure in his face this morning, he had reason. Lee had conferred with Davis and wired back, countermanding Johnston's orders. The march would be north, Jackson told Taylor, and sat his horse beside the pike to watch the gaitered dandies set off down it. His mount was a close-coupled, thick-necked, ox-eyed creature, taken from the enemy a year ago this month. Little Sorrel was its name, but the men called it Fancy in derision. They made a strange pair, the undersized, rather muscle-bound horse and the tall, angular rider with his ill-fitting clothes and his taciturnity. A certain aura was gathering around him, a magnetism definite but impersonal. "No one could love the man for himself," one of his officers wrote home. "He seems to be cut off from his fellow men and to commune with his own spirit only, or with spirits of which we know not." Another put it more briefly, calling him a one-ideaed man. Two things he believed in absolutely, the vigorous use of the bayonet and the blessings of Providence, and he would not be distracted in his efforts to employ them. Lately he had inquired sharply about a missing courier and was told that the boy had just been killed while delivering a message under fire. "Very commendable, very commendable," Jackson muttered, and went back to the matter at hand. A mile beyond Newmarket, just as Taylor's men settled down for the 25-mile march he thought would end with an assault on Banks's main body in its Strasburg entrenchments, the Louisiana brigadier got orders to swing right and take the road across Massanutten, back into the narrow valley he had left the day before. He scarcely knew what to make of this, but presently, hiking through the lofty gap that gave simultaneous breathtaking views of the Blue Ridge and the Alleghenies, he decided that Stonewall was an unconscious poet who desired to give strangers an opportunity to admire the beauties of his valley. Though his father and his brother-in-law, Zachary Taylor and Jefferson Davis, had been professional soldiers, Taylor himself had attended Yale and Harvard, not West Point. He could not yet see that his arrival had thickened the column, which, by now, Banks's scouts would have reported advancing northward on the pike, an illusion that was being continued by the cavalry, which had been left on the west side of the mountain, under orders to keep up the threatening movement, letting no one through or past with information that the infantry had turned off. It was a hard leg-throbbing march, steeply uphill, then steeply down, but at its end the two wings of the Army of the Valley were united at Luray. When the cavalry crossed the ridge tomorrow morning, Jackson would have 17,000 soldiers concentrated for a strike at Banks's dispersed 9,000. Rewarded at last for sticking by a man he swore was crazy, Ewell had absorbed his commander's spirit to such an extent that he spoke with his very accent. "We can get along without anything but food and ammunition," he warned his subordinates. "The road to glory cannot be followed with much baggage." Not only Ewell, but a good part of the men in the ranks could appreciate now what Stonewall had wrought, usually to their bewilderment and over their muttered objections. 20 miles ahead lay Front Royal. Once its 1,000-man garrison had been scattered or wiped out, Jackson would be on Banks's flank and astride the Manassas Gap Railroad, blocking his path of retreat across the Blue Ridge. If he stayed to fight, outnumbered worse than 2-1, with his back to his Strasburg entrenchments, he would be overwhelmed. Or if he fled northward down the pike toward the Potomac, he might be caught in motion and destroyed. Jackson had the answer to his prayers. Meanwhile, as always, his principal concern was secrecy, and for this he had the covered approach of the Luray Valley, leading directly to Front Royal. Next day, May 22nd, while the cavalry was fading back from Strasburg to rejoin the main body, the infantry marched to within 10 miles of Front Royal, near enough to get there early the following afternoon with plenty of daylight left for fighting, yet far enough back to keep from alarming the unsuspecting garrison, then halted for a good night's sleep before the day of battle. Up and on the way by dawn, with Ewell in the lead, Jackson sent his troopers ahead to circle east and west of the town, tearing up sections of railroad track and clipping telegraph wires to prevent the arrival of reinforcements from Strasburg or Manassas and the spreading of alarm in either direction. The odds being what they were, 17-1, the fight could have only one outcome. But Stonewall wanted more than a lopsided victory that would yield him nothing more than control of an isolated outpost. He wanted to kill or capture every bluecoat in the place. That was about what it came to in the end, though for a time the thing was touch and go. Learning that the garrison was the Federal 1st Maryland, Ewell halted his column long enough to pass the Confederate 1st Maryland to the front. They came at a trot, anxious to have at the homemade Yankees, as they called them. About 2 o'clock they struck the advance picket, drove it back through the streets of Front Royal, and came upon the main body, drawn up north of town, preparing to resist what its colonel thought was a guerrilla raid. He soon found out better, but he continued fighting, determined to hold his ground, whatever the odds. Both forks of the Shenandoah were at his back, crossable only by 3 narrow bridges, 2 over the South Fork and 1 over the North. So that when he saw a body of Grayback cavalry riding hard to cut him off, he knew it was no use. Falling back, he won the race for the North Fork Bridge, crossed it, and held off the troopers with his 2 rifled guns while his rear guard set the wooden span afire. Jackson looked down from the heights south of town and saw the Federals escaping, a compact blue column hurrying north beyond the spiral of smoke from the burning bridge, whose flames kept the Confederates from pursuit. "Oh, what an opportunity for artillery! Oh, that my guns were here!" he cried, and turning to his staff, he shouted, "Order up every rifled gun and every brigade in the army!" It was easier said than done. The guns were far back, and only 3 of the 48 were rifled. But Stonewall did not wait for their arrival. He rode down the hill and beyond the town, where a glad sight awaited him. The skirmishers had beaten out the flames, preserving enough of the damaged span to permit a crossing by horsemen. The general sent about 250 cavalry in pursuit of the Federals, who had disappeared over a ridge. They soon caught up, forcing a stand, and charged. The bluecoats broke, tried another stand, were charged again, and scattered. By now the infantry had caught up. Gleefully, the rebel Marylanders beat the bushes, rounding up their late compatriots and neighbors. Out of 1,063, the Federals lost 904 killed or captured. Jackson had fewer than 50 casualties, all told. Mostly they were cavalry, shot from their saddles in the two headlong charges that made his victory complete. When first reports of the disaster reached Strasburg that same Friday, Banks informed Washington that the attack had been made by a rebel force of 5,000, which had been gathering in the mountains, it is said, since Wednesday. Reinforcements should be sent us if possible. Troops would be sent, he was told in reply. Do not give up the ship before succor can arrive. He had no intention of giving up the ship, but by the following morning his estimate of the enemy strength had risen to not less than 6,000 to 10,000. It is probably Ewell's force passing through the Shenandoah Valley. Jackson is still in our front. He added, we shall stand firm. Presently the ugly truth came home. Jackson was not in our front, nor was Ewell merely passing through. They were not only united, they were united on Banks's flank, moving, he heard, toward Middletown, which was 6 miles in his rear, one-third of the way to Winchester, his main supply base. Still, Banks was determined not to budge. I must develop the force of the enemy, he kept saying. When one of his brigade commanders, Colonel G.H. Gordon, who had attended West Point with Jackson, came to reason with him, urging that the proper action would be to fall back in an attempt to save his men and supplies, the former governor said he would not hear of it. He intended to stand firm. It is not a retreat, Gordon explained, but a true military movement to escape from being cut off, to prevent stores and sick from falling into the hands of the enemy. By God, sir, Banks cried hotly, I will not retreat. We have more to fear from the opinions of our friends than the bayonets of our enemies. Gordon now saw what the trouble was. Banks was afraid of being accused of being afraid. The colonel rose. This, sir, is not a military reason for occupying a false position, he said. He returned to his camp, saw to the packing of his stores and baggage, got the wagons headed for Winchester, and alerted his men for the order he knew was inevitable. At last it came. The army would fall back, Banks informed him. Jackson spent a good part of the night staring thoughtfully into a campfire, exploring a problem in geometry. At Strasburg and Front Royal, opposite ends of the base of the triangle resting against the northern face of Massanutten, he and Banks were equidistant from the apex at Winchester. By marching fast, he could get there first and capture or destroy the Federal supply dump. But Stonewall wanted more than Banks's supplies. He wanted his army, too. There was the nub of the problem. If he set out north in a race for Winchester, Banks might move eastward across his wake and get away eastward beyond the Blue Ridge. Or if he marched west against Strasburg, Banks might flee northward down the pike and save both his army and his stores. Morning came before the problem had been solved, but at least it had been explored. The latter being the graver risk, Jackson decided to take the former. With luck, or as he preferred to express it, with the assistance of an ever-kind providence, he might still accomplish both his goals. Luck or providence seemed at first to be against him. The weather had turned blustery overnight, and the wind was whipping rain in the men's faces. Slow to fall in, they were even slower in getting started. Before long, the rain turned to hail, plopping into the mud and pelting the marchers. Press on, men, press on, Jackson urged them, riding alongside. His impatience increased when he received a cavalry report that Banks was blowing up his Strasburg ammunition dump, preparing to evacuate. In hopes of catching the Federals in motion on the pike, he sent a section of artillery, supported by Wheat's Tigers, on a road that branched west to Middletown, 7 miles away, while the rest of the army continued slogging north, straining to outstrip the head of the Federal column somewhere short of Winchester, where their paths converged. Almost nothing went right for the Southerners today, and to lengthen the odds, in spite of his original reluctance, which had given him an even later start than his opponent, Banks was showing a real talent for retreat. His rested men hiked fast on the macadamized pike, while stone walls plodded wearily through mud. Twice the Union column was cut at Middletown and 5 miles beyond, with resultant slaughter and confusion, but both were basically rearguard actions, marred by the fact that the hungry Confederates could not be kept from plundering abandoned wagons instead of forging ahead after more, and the cavalry practically disbanded as the troopers set out for their nearby homes with captured horses. Jackson was furious, but neither he nor Taylor, who brought his brigade across country to join the pursuit along the turnpike, could deal with more than a handful at a time, and even these returned to their looting as soon as the generals' backs were turned. They would fight when they had to, as, for instance, in repulsing a 2,000-man cavalry charge, which they did in style, emptying hundreds of saddles, but otherwise they were concerned with nothing they could not stuff in their mouths or pockets. For all their slackness, the pursuers were gleaning a rich harvest of prisoners and equipment. Too badly outnumbered to turn and fight until he gained a strong defensive position, Banks was sacrificing companies in rearguard ambuscades and dribbling wagons in his wake like tubs to Jackson's whale. With them, he was buying time and distance so successfully that by sunset, it was obvious that his main body was winning the race for Winchester, where just such a strong position awaited him. Even Stonewall was obliged to admit it. But he had no intention of allowing his quarry any more time than he could possibly avoid. He pushed his weary brigades through the gathering twilight. "Press on, men," he kept saying. Impatiently, he rode with the handful of cavalry in advance, when suddenly the darkness ahead was stitched with muzzle flashes. The troopers drew rein. "Charge them! Charge them!" Jackson shouted. A second volley crashed ahead. Bullets whistled past. The horsemen scattered, leaving the general alone in the middle of the road. "Shameful!" he cried after them in his shrill, womanish voice. "Did you see anybody struck, sir? Did you see anybody struck?" He sat there among the twittering bullets, still complaining. Surely they need not have run, at least until they were hurt. Sheepishly, the troopers returned, and Jackson sent them forward, following with the infantry. Kernstown lay dead ahead, the scene of blundering in March. Tonight, it was Sunday again by now, as then, there was only a brief skirmish in the darkness. Winchester lay 4 miles beyond, and he did not intend to allow Banks time to add to the natural strength of the double line of hills south of town. When one officer remarked that his men were falling by the roadside from fatigue and loss of sleep, "Unless they are rested," he complained, "I shall be able to present but a thin line tomorrow," Jackson replied. "Colonel, I yield to no man in sympathy for the gallant men under my command, but I am obliged to sweat them tonight that I may save their blood tomorrow." He pressed on through Kernstown, but eventually saw that the colonel was right. If he kept on at this rate, he would arrive with almost no army at all. He called a halt, and the men crumpled in their tracks, asleep as soon as their heads touched the ground. Jackson did not share their rest. He was thinking of the double line of hills ahead, outlining a plan of battle. At 4 o'clock, unable to wait any longer, he had the sleepy men aroused and herded back onto the road. Before the stars had paled, he was approaching the high ground south of Winchester. To his relief, he saw that Banks had chosen to make his stand on the second ridge, leaving only a few troops on the first. Quickly, Stonewall threw out skirmishers, drove the pickets off, and brought up guns to support the assault he would launch as soon as his army filed into position. Banks had his cannon zeroed in, blasting away at the rebel guns while the infantry formed their lines. Jackson saw that the work would be hot despite his advantage of numbers. Riding back to bring up Taylor, whose Louisianians he planned to use as shock troops, he passed some Virginia regiments coming forward. They had been ordered not to cheer lest they give away their position. But as Jackson rode by, they took off their hats in salute to the man who had driven them, stumbling with fatigue to where the guns were growling. He removed his battered cap, riding in silence past the uncovered Virginians, and came upon Taylor, whom he greeted with a question. "General, can your brigade charge a battery?" "It can try." "Very good. It must do it, then. Move it forward." Taylor did so. Passing along the ridge, the Louisianians came under fire from the Union guns. Shells screamed at them, tearing gaps in their ranks, and the men began to bob and weave. "What the hell are you dodging for?" Taylor yelled. "If there is any more of it, you will be halted under this fire for an hour." As they snapped back to attention, he felt a hand on his shoulder. He looked around. "I am afraid you are a wicked fellow," Jackson said, and rode away. What followed was brief but decisive. Taylor's charge on the left was a page out of picture book war, a long line of men in gray sweeping forward after their commander, who gestured on horseback, pointing the way through shell bursts with his sword. On the opposite flank, Ewell had come into position up the front Royal Road in time to share in the assault. In the center, the Stonewall Brigade surged forward, down the first slope and up the second, where 7,000 Federals were breaking for the rear at the sight of 16,000 Confederates bearing down on them, or strictly speaking, up at them, from three different directions. The attackers swept over the second ridge and charged through Winchester, firing after the bluecoats as they ran. Jackson rode among his soldiers, his eyes aglow at the sight. "Order forward the whole line! The battle's won!" he shouted. All around him, men were kneeling to fire after the scampering Yankees. He snatched off his cap and waved it over his head in exultation. "Very good!" he cried. "Now let's holler!" The men took it up, and the Valley Army's first concerted rebel yell rang out so loud it seemed to rock the houses. Stonewall cheered as wildly as the rest. When a staff officer tried to remonstrate with him for thus exposing himself, he paid him no mind except to shout full in his face, "Go back and tell the whole army to press forward to the Potomac." The Potomac was 36 miles ahead, but distance meant nothing to Jackson so long as an opportunity like the present was spread before his eyes. North of Winchester, all the way to the horizon, Banks's army was scattered in headlong flight, as ripe for the saber this fine May morning as grain for the scythe in July. At Front Royal, his artillery had failed him. Today it was his cavalry. As he watched the blue fugitives scurry out of musket range, the valley commander clenched his fists and groaned, "Never was there such a chance for cavalry! Oh, that my cavalry were in place!" Attempting to improvise a horseback pursuit, he brought up the nearest batteries, had the teams uncoupled, and mounted the cannoneers. But he soon saw it would not do. The horses were worn out, wobbly from fatigue, and so were the men. The best he could manage was to follow at a snail's pace through the waning Sunday afternoon, picking up what the fleeing enemy dropped. Added to what had already been gleaned in 3 days of marching and fighting, the harvest was considerable, entirely aside from the Federal dead, the uncaptured wounded, and the tons of goods that had gone up in smoke. At a cost of 400 casualties, 68 killed, 329 wounded, and 3 missing, Jackson had taken 3,030 prisoners, 9,300 small arms, 2 rifled cannon, and such a wealth of quartermaster stores of all descriptions that his opponent was known thereafter as Commissary Banks. Those were only the immediate and material fruits of the opening phase of the campaign. A larger gain, as Lee had foreseen or at any rate had aimed at, was in its effect on Lincoln, who once more swung round to find the Shenandoah shotgun loaded and leveled at his head. Banks put on a brave face as soon as he got what was left of his army beyond the Potomac. "It is seldom that a river crossing of such magnitude is achieved with greater success," he reported, though he admitted that there were never more grateful hearts in the same number of men than when, at midday of the 26th, we stood on the opposite shore. He denied that his command had suffered an attack and rout, but had accomplished a premeditated march of nearly 60 miles in the face of the enemy, defeating his plans and giving him battle wherever he was found. Lincoln was not deceived. Anxious though he was for reassurance, he saw clearly that Banks was in no condition to repulse the rebels if they continued their advance beyond the Potomac. In fact, he had already reacted exactly as Lee had hoped and intended. Shields had reached McDowell, and they had set out to join McClellan in front of Richmond. But on Saturday, as soon as news reached Washington of the disaster at Front Royal, they were halted 6 miles south of the Rappahannock and ordered to countermarch for operations against Jackson. McDowell replied with a heavy heart that he would attempt what the president commanded, though he did not believe the movement would succeed. "I'm entirely beyond helping distance of General Banks," he told Lincoln. "No celerity or vigor will avail so far as he is concerned." Nor did he have a high opinion of Lincoln's scheme to use him to recover control of the valley. "I shall gain nothing for you there and shall lose much for you here. I feel that it throws us all back, and from Richmond north we shall have our large masses paralyzed." The commander-in-chief thanked him for his promptness but rejected his advice. "For you it is a question of legs," he urged as soon as McDowell's men were on the march for the valley. "Put in all the speed you can." Lincoln had something more in mind than the relief of pressure on Banks or even the salvation of Washington. He wanted to capture Jackson, bag and baggage. Poring over maps of northern Virginia, he had evolved a plan whereby he would block the rebel general's retreat and crush him with overwhelming numbers. McDowell's command advancing on the valley from the east was one jaw of the crusher. Fremont's was the other. Concentrated at Franklin, the Pathfinder was 30 miles from Harrisonburg, which was 80 miles in Stonewall's rear. Lincoln wired instructions for him to move against Jackson at Harrisonburg and operate against the enemy in such a way as to relieve Banks. He added, "This movement must be made immediately. You will acknowledge the receipt of this order and specify the hour it is received by you." Fremont replied within the hour that he would march at once. "Put the utmost speed into it. Do not lose a minute," Lincoln admonished. And having ordered the combination of two large forces in the presence of the enemy, the movement Napoleon characterized as the most difficult in the art of war, he sat back like a long-distance chess player to await results. Not that he was not kept busy with other matters growing out of this one. The North was in turmoil. Intelligence from various quarters leaves no doubt that the enemy in great force are advancing on Washington. Stanton wired the governors of 13 states, asking them to send him whatever militia they could lay hands on. 3 others were told, "Send all the troops forward that you can immediately. Banks is completely routed. The enemy in large force are advancing upon Harper's Ferry." Recruiting offices were reopened. The railroads were taken over to provide speedy transportation for reinforcements before the capital was beleaguered. Rumors spread fast on Monday, so quickly had Sunday's bolt come tumbling. The New York Herald, whose morning edition had carried an editorial captioned "Fall of Richmond," replaced it with a report that the whole rebel army was on the march for the Potomac. Harried by congressmen and distraught citizens, Lincoln hoped that his opponent in the Confederate seat of government could be given a hard time, too. To McClellan in front of Richmond went a wire. "Can you get near enough to throw shells into the city?" The young Napoleon was scarcely in a mood to throw anything at anybody, except possibly at Lincoln. When he first got the news that McDowell would not be joining him just yet, after all, his first reaction was, "Heaven save a country governed by such counsels." On second thought, however, he could see at least one benefit proceeding from the panic in the capital. A scare will do them good and may bring them to their senses. But the president wired on Sunday that the enemy movement was general and concerted, not merely a bluff or an act of desperation. "I think the time is near," he wrote, "when you must either attack Richmond or else give up the job and come to the defense of Washington." McClellan reacted fast. The last thing he wanted in this world was to return to that sink within reach of those hounds. Replying that the time is very near when I shall attack, he added that he disagreed with Lincoln's appraisal of Confederate strategy. "The object of the movement is probably to prevent reinforcements being sent to me. All the information from balloons, deserters, prisoners, and contrabands agrees in the statement that the mass of the rebel troops are still in the immediate vicinity of Richmond, ready to defend it." Lincoln knew how to translate "very near" and also how to assess McClellan's estimates as to the strength of an enemy entrenched to his front. He had encountered both before. Just now, though, his attention was distracted. On Tuesday, May 27th, he received from Fremont a message that alarmed him. Not because of what it said, but because of the heading, which showed that the Pathfinder had moved north instead of east. "I see that you are at Moorefield," Lincoln wired. "You were expressly ordered to march to Harrisonburg. What does this mean?" Fremont replied that it meant the road leading east from Franklin was impossible, that he had swung north to pick up food for his men who otherwise would have starved, and that he was obeying instructions to relieve Banks in the best way he saw fit, by marching on Strasburg. "In executing any order received," he declared, "I take it for granted that I am to exercise discretion concerning its literal execution, according to circumstances. If I am to understand that literal obedience to orders is required, please say so." The reply threw Lincoln into much the same state as when he flung his hat on the floor at Fort Monroe 3 weeks ago. Fremont now had 70 miles to march instead of 30. However, McDowell was closing in fast from the east, and Jackson was still reported near Harper's Ferry. There was plenty of time to cut him off if the troops marched on schedule. On May 30th, Lincoln sent two wires, one to Fremont. "You must be up in the time you promised," the other to McDowell. "The game is before you." 3 days later, he had Stanton give them both a final warning. "Do not let the enemy escape you." For once, Jackson, the game, as Lincoln styled him, was exactly where the Federal High Command had him spotted, at Charlestown, with his infantry thrown forward to demonstrate against Harper's Ferry, 7 miles away. Though he had known for 2 days now of the forces moving east and west toward a convergence that would put 35,000 soldiers in his rear, nothing in his manner showed that the information bothered him at all. After setting Monday aside for rest and prayer, in compensation for another violated Sabbath, he had come on by easy marches, driving the enemy not merely toward the Potomac, as Lee had suggested, but to and beyond it. While the reassembled cavalry was pressing northward down the Valley Pike, through Martinsburg and on to the Williamsport crossing, the infantry took the fork that branched northeast to Harper's Ferry. It was all rather anticlimactic, though, even lackadaisical, compared to what had gone before, and on the 28th, the day he was warned of the movement that threatened to cut off his retreat, he ordered his troops to resume the prescribed 4 hours of daily drill. Howls went up from the ranks at this, but the howls availed the outraged soldiers no more than did the complaints of the staff that the present delay would result in utter ruin. If Jackson was oblivious to the danger in his rear, they certainly were not. Once more they called him crack-brained, and one young officer muttered darkly, "Quem Deus vult perdere, prius dementat." There was no middle ground for confidence where Stonewall was concerned. You either trusted him blindly or you judged him absolutely mad. That was the obverse of his method, never better illustrated than now. It was true that he had already wrung every possible psychological advantage from his present exposed position, which he knew was growing more perilous by the hour. But there were other considerations. He had 2,300 unparoled prisoners on his hands, each of whom could be exchanged for a southern soldier now in a northern prison camp. And near Winchester, his chief of transportation was assembling a double line of wagons 8 miles long, loaded with a wealth of captured goods, including 9,000 badly needed rifles, mostly new, and invaluable medical equipment shut off from the Confederacy by blockade. All this took time, but Jackson was determined to give the grinding column of spoils and captives a head start up the valley turnpike before he attempted to bring his army out of the two-jawed trap about to snap shut in its rear. On May 30th, when the long train started rolling south, there were even more urgent reasons for the army to follow in its wake at once. Intelligence reports placed the advance of McDowell's column within a day's march of Front Royal, and Fremont's about the same distance from Strasburg, both of which places were more than 40 miles in Jackson's rear. Banks had been reinforced at Williamsport and presumably was about ready to take the field again, tamping the Confederates into the grinder that would be created when Fremont and McDowell met in the shadow of the northern face of Massanutten Mountain. Nothing in Stonewall's manner expressed concern, however, when he emerged from his tent this Friday morning. After receiving a delegation of Charlestown ladies who called to pay their respects, he rode toward Harper's Ferry and watched some desultory skirmishing. When a shower of rain came up, he stretched out under a tree for shelter and presently fell asleep. He woke to find A.R. Butler, a Valley congressman who had volunteered for duty on his staff, making a sketch of him. Jackson studied it, then remarked, "Colonel, I have some harder work than this for you to do, and if you'll sit down here now, I'll tell you what it is. I want you to go to Richmond for me. I must have reinforcements. You can explain to them down there what the situation is here." Butler replied that he would be glad to go, but that he was not sure he understood the situation. Whereupon Jackson outlined it for him. "McDowell and Fremont are probably aiming to effect a junction at Strasburg, so as to cut us off from the upper valley, and are both nearer to it now than we are. Consequently, no time is to be lost. You can say to them in Richmond that I'll send on the prisoners, secure most if not all of the captured property, and with God's blessing we'll be able to baffle the enemy's plans here with my present force, but that it will have to be increased as soon thereafter as possible." If Butler thought the general wanted to use those reinforcements merely to help stand off the various columns now converging on him, he was much mistaken, as he discovered from what Stonewall said in closing. "You may tell them, too, that if my command can be gotten up to 40,000 men, a movement may be made which will soon raise the siege of Richmond and transfer this campaign from the banks of the Potomac to those of the Susquehanna." Riding south with all the speed he could manage, by rail to Winchester, by horseback to Stanton, by rail again to Richmond, the congressman-colonel arrived to find that the Eastern Theater's first major engagement since Manassas, 80 miles away and 10 full months ago, had been fought at the city's gates while he was traveling. With his back to the wall and the choice narrowed to resistance or evacuation, Johnston at last had found conditions suitable for attack. In point of fact, despite his fondness for keeping the tactical situation fluid, in hopes that his opponent would commit some error or be guilty of some oversight, and thereby expose a portion of the Blue Host to destruction, Johnston really had no choice. With McDowell poised for a southward advance, a junction that would give the Federals nearly a 3-to-1 advantage over the 53,688 Confederates drawn up east of Richmond, Not even evacuation would assure the salvation of Johnston's army, which now, as always, was his main concern. McClellan would still be after him, and with overwhelming numbers. The only thing to do, he saw, was to strike one Mac before the other got there. Besides, the error he had been hoping for seemed already to have been committed. McClellan's five corps were unequally divided, three north and two south of the Chickahominy. Normally a sluggish stream, not even too broad for leaping in the dry months, the river was greatly swollen as a result of the continual spring rains, and thus might serve to isolate the Union wings, preventing their mutual support and giving the Confederates a chance to slash at one or the other with equal or perhaps superior numbers. Johnston would have preferred to attack the weaker South Bank wing, keeping Richmond covered as he did so, but this would not only leave McDowell's line of advance unblocked, it would probably also hasten the junction by provoking a rapid march from Fredericksburg when McClellan yelled for help. By elimination, then, Johnston determined to strike down the North Bank, risking uncovering Richmond for the sake of wrecking McClellan's right wing and blocking McDowell's advance at the same time. He had his plan, a product of necessity, but as usual he took his time and kept his counsel as he took it. Least of all did he confer with the President, afterwards explaining, "I could not consult him without adopting the course he might advise, so that to ask his advice would have been, in my opinion, to ask him to command for me." The result, with the Federals a rapid 2-hour march away, was a terrible strain on Davis. Unable to get the general's assurance that an all-out defense of the city would be attempted, he never knew from day to day which flag might be flying over the capital tomorrow. May 22nd, riding out the Mechanicsville Turnpike with Lee, he found few troops, no fortifications, indeed no preparations of any kind, as he wrote Johnston, for blocking a sudden Union drive toward, if not to, Richmond. 2 days later, Johnston came to town for a conference, but he told his superior nothing except that he intended to be governed by circumstances. To make matters worse, while he was there, the Federals seized Mechanicsville, 5 miles north, just as Davis had predicted. Not only was this an excellent location for a hookup when McDowell made his 3- or 4-day march from Fredericksburg, but now there was nothing at all to stand in the way of such an advance, Johnston having instructed Anderson to fall back from the line of the Rappahannock. 2 days later, May 26th, while he was reviewing the situation with Lee, the President's anxiety over Johnston's undivulged intentions was so obviously painful that Lee proposed, "Let me go and see him and defer this discussion until I return." When he was gone, a dispatch arrived from Jackson, who broke his silence with an outright shout of joy. "During the past 3 days," it began, "God has blessed our arms with brilliant success. Banks had been routed and Stonewall was in pursuit, capturing the fugitives." Whether this would have the intended effect of frightening the Union High Command into holding back McDowell remained to be seen, but the news was a tonic for Davis, arriving as it did at the very crisis of his concern. Presently Lee returned, to be heartened by this early yield from the seeds of strategy he had sown in the valley, and to deliver tidings that bore directly on the subject of the President's anxiety. Johnston at last had announced his decision to attack. Intended to crumple McClellan's right wing, which brushed the purlieus of the city, the strike would be made on the 29th. That was Thursday. Today was Monday. Davis braced himself for the 3-day wait. McClellan was quite aware of the danger of straddling what he called the confounded Chickahominy, but his instructions left him no choice. In the dispatch of the 17th, rewarding his prayers with the announcement that McDowell would be moving south as soon as Shields arrived, Stanton had told McClellan, "He is ordered, keeping himself always in position to save the capital from all possible attack, so to operate as to place his left wing in communication with your right wing, and you are instructed to cooperate, so as to establish this communication as soon as possible by extending your right wing to the north of Richmond. That was that, and there was nothing he could do to change it, though he tried. Next day, as if he knew how little an appeal to Stanton would avail him, he wired Secretary Seward, "Indications that the enemy intend fighting at Richmond. Policy seems to be to concentrate everything there. They hold central position and will seek to meet us while divided. I think we are committing a great military error in having so many independent columns. The great battle should be fought by our troops in mass, then divide if necessary." 3 days later, when this had brought no change in his instructions, he wrote to his friend Burnside, "The government have deliberately placed me in this position. If I win, the greater the glory. If I lose, they will be damned forever, both by God and men." Consoled by this prediction as to the verdict that would be recorded in history as in heaven, and reassured the following day by a message from Fredericksburg, "Shields will join me today," McDowell wrote, and announced that he would be ready to march on the 24th with 38,000 men and 11,000 animals. McClellan took heart and labored to make the dangerous waiting period as brief as possible. On the scheduled date, he sent his cavalry to drive the rebels out of Mechanicsville, thus extending his grasp north of Richmond in accordance with Stanton's instructions. Before the day was over, however, he received a telegram from the president which informed him that he was clutching at emptiness. "In consequence of General Banks's position, I have been compelled to suspend McDowell's movements." Next day, with Banks broken up into a total rout, Lincoln explained his action by combining a justification with an appeal. "Apprehensions of something like this, and no unwillingness to sustain you, have always been my reason for withholding McDowell from you. Please understand this and do the best you can with the force you have." That was what McClellan did. Though he found the order perfectly sickening, he took comfort at least in the fact that McDowell's southward movement had been suspended, not revoked, and he worked hard to strengthen his army's position astride the river and to pave the way for the eventual junction on the right as soon as the Fredericksburg command got back from what McDowell himself considered a wild goose chase. 11 new bridges, all long and difficult with extensive logway approaches, were erected across the swollen Chickahominy between Mechanicsville and Bottoms Bridge, 12 miles apart. It was an arduous and unending task, for the spans not only had to be constructed, they often had to be replaced. The river, still rising, though it was already higher than it had been in 20 years, swept them away about as fast as they were built. While thus providing as best he could for mutual support by the two wings in event that either was attacked, he saw to the improvement of the tactical position of each. Keyes, supported by Heintzelman on the south bank, pushed forward along the Williamsburg Road on the 25th, and, a mile and a half beyond Seven Pines, constructed a redoubt within 5 miles of the heart of the enemy capital. Though McClellan could not comply with Lincoln's request next day that he throw some shells into the city, he could see Richmond's tallest steeples from both extremities of his line, north and south of the river, and hear the public clocks as they struck the quiet hours after midnight. On the north bank, Porter was farthest out. Behind him were Franklin, in close support, and Sumner, who occupied what was called the center of the position, 8 miles downstream from Mechanicsville. The latter's corps was theoretically on call as a reserve for either wing, though the rising flood was steadily increasing its pressure on the two bridges he had built for crossing the river in event of an attack on Keyes or Heintzelman. To protect his rear on the north bank and to shorten McDowell's march from Fredericksburg, McClellan on the 27th had Porter take a reinforced division 12 miles north to Hanover Courthouse, where a Confederate brigade had halted on its 50-mile retreat from Gordonsville. Porter encountered the rebels about noon, and after a short but sharp engagement drove them headlong, capturing a gun and 2 regimental supply trains. At a cost of 397 casualties, he inflicted more than 1,000, including 730 prisoners, and added greatly to the morale of his corps. It was handsomely done. McClellan was delighted. The sizable haul of men and equipment indicated a decline of the enemy's fighting spirit. Lying quiescent all this time in the Richmond entrenchments, despite his reported advantage in numbers, Joe Johnston seemed to lack the nerve for a strike at the divided Federal army. At this rate, the contest would soon degenerate into a siege, a type of warfare at which his young friend George was an expert. "We are getting on splendidly," McClellan wrote his wife before he went to bed that night. "I am quietly clearing out everything that could threaten my rear and communications, providing against the contingency of disaster, and so arranging as to make my whole force available in the approaching battle. The only fear is that Joe's heart may fail him." That seemed to be about what had happened Thursday morning when, after hurrying through some office work, Davis rode out to observe the scheduled attack, but found the troops lounging at ease in the woods and heard no sound of gunfire anywhere along the line. Johnston had told him nothing of canceling or postponing the battle. Davis was left to wonder and fret until late in the day, when investigation uncovered what had happened. At a council of war held the previous night for issuing final instructions, something in the nature of a miracle had been announced. Only the day before, Johnston had been given definite information that McDowell was on the march. Already 6 miles south of Fredericksburg, his advance was within 30 miles of Hanover Courthouse, where Porter had been waiting since his midday repulse of the Confederate brigade.